control, searching for the depth of my own soul. I breathe but far beneath, my cover keeps the red from leaking. I'm bleeding on the inside, fear before the fall. 6 feet above the next time, I lose it all.
Alien Podcast, with your hosts Paul Mano and Matt McAfee, Episode 9, The UFO Crash in Aurora, Texas, with special guest, Daniel Allen Jones.
Okay, tonight we'd like to welcome our special guest, Daniel Allen Jones. He is the founder of Vortexus.net and the Texas Cryptozoology Network. He is an expert researcher with a vast knowledge of his subjects and an all-around hell of a nice guy, really. Welcome to the show, Daniel Allen Jones.
Thanks for the introduction, Matt. I'm glad to be on here with you and Paul. There's a lot of great information that we can get into for the show, and I'm excited to be here with you guys.
We're going to be talking about the Aurora crash of 1897. Many of you know that's one of my favorite topics. We've discussed it before on the show. We've gone into some detail about correlations between Roswell and Aurora. Daniel here has a vast knowledge, and Daniel, I really appreciate you coming on. I know it was relatively short notice, but I wanted to try to actually get this recorded this evening. I'm not sure whether or not you know, it's actually kind of a special day for one of our mutual friends. Dr. Toni Wheeler is celebrating her birthday today.
That's right, and glad to be able to wish her and her family that they're doing great, and wish her a happy birthday, and she's been a big part of, as you know, the successful events that we've had in Aurora here in the last few years. So I'm grateful to be able to have worked with her and hope that she's enjoying her special day today.
Hopefully she is. She was very instrumental in it, as well as you were. And of course, the late Jim Mars, you were all very instrumental in putting together the first annual Aurora Alien Encounter in 2016. And I know this past April, you actually were able to put together a gathering there in Aurora. How did all of that go?
Sure, yeah, and I'm glad to have been able to work with Jim, and he was a good friend, and we were able to, you know, do a lot with Aurora, which I'm very thankful for. And like you said, this past April, we were able to go out and put together a sort of meetup and do a little tour of both the crash site, which is got a new monument that's nearby, and then the cemetery where the alleged body is buried. And so we had about, let's say, 100 people turn out or more, and it was just an interesting gathering for people who had, you know, never heard about it, to people who were fans and interested and had, you know, been to different events and things similar. But also, for what I find particularly interesting, is some of the people that were around the town that were, you know, locals that came out, able to share a little bit about what they knew, and finding some, you know, relationships that way as well, is kind of interesting perspective, you know, gaining insight on some of the different aspects of the history, let's say, for instance, that might not have been known or shared because no one ever talked to those people. And I know Jim was someone who really tried to find out a sense of legitimacy of a lot of the claims, and, you know, really dig into it as an investigative journalist to find out the truth behind the matter and get to the facts and really be able to share that with people in a way that shows, okay, is this a real incident or was it a hoax, or what are we dealing with overall, and, you know, get down to it. And, you know, I think that's something that's important to continue a legacy of, and in a way that people can tangibly go out there. So we had a great time, and we really enjoyed the opportunity that the city is allowing for people to learn a little bit more about something, I'd say, an interesting phenomenon that they may not have right here. Now we're right here within the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex.
Jim always called Aurora the smoking gun of ufology, and I think he was absolutely right about that. He really was an amazing man who really opened up a lot of this to the entire world.
I think so. It's really great to see how he was a big popularizer of the case. And it's kind of a worldwide phenomenon now, and a lot of people come from all over the world to go see the site. And I think it's interesting just to find that even within that, you can see that it sparks at least enough public interest to maintain somewhat of a consistent, activity of people's involvement. I think it's really great to celebrate some of these commemorative events in a way that people can acknowledge a little bit of what could be happening right here, in the neighborhood. So it's really a great opportunity for people in the community to come out. And, we had a lot of local food trucks and people coming out from the city to share about different opportunities. And it was a great event.
Yeah, I really wish I could have made it this year, but I think on that weekend I had some work priorities that of course had to take precedence over it, unfortunately. But I was missing that, being able to go out there and meet everybody and talk to everybody and, of course, catch up with you. You and I haven't even had the opportunity to catch up in quite a while.
Sure, and I know we've been able to get together in a few occasions, but it's always a good time to be able to connect. And as you said earlier, with Jim and his passing of last year almost here in just a few days on the 2nd, it's something that I think is really worth mentioning, because he was really who helped me to understand a lot more about what we could be dealing with and as far as Aurora goes. And so it's great to be able to share his work in a way that people can recognize him and what he was in pursuit of throughout his life. So, I appreciate your opportunity to have, mention for Jim, and he's about to have another grandchild, which is really great as well. Of course, his wife, Carol, is now upstate, and she's with her family there. And so, yeah, it's been about a year since his passing, and we're glad to have had him come and be part of the annual event, or the premier event that we held back in 2016, like you said.
Oh, I certainly miss him. I think the entire UFO community really misses him. And it was just really a sad loss. And believe it or not, I still think about it pretty much every day. I drive by Jim's house every day. Man, I really could have learned so much more from him if we would have just had more time. I still remember the final thing he said to me when we were there in Aurora. He told me, he said, Matt, I envy people like you and Daniel. You guys are really standing at the cusp of everything. I really believe that this is the golden age of ufology. I believe he was right about that. Within a few years, we may see things like Disclosure. We have the To the Stars Academy releasing information in December, which was really kind of shocked the world. And it was nice to see our government finally have to admit, yes, we've been investigating these. Just to see it all, I think, has been great.
I think so. It seems to be a really exciting and active time for this field. And for anyone who's been following along throughout the years, it's really, been hit and miss with some of the public announcements and disclosures, as it were. But it seems here recently, last December, we had the big announcement, like you said, the Pentagon's program. We're dealing with ATIP and the Advanced Aerial Threat Identification Program. And it's something that a lot of people are really finding out more about now than they ever really could before. And this gives us an opportunity for there to be more public awareness of this subject. And I think people like Jim really did a great job of, again, investigating and seeing what there is to it. And if there's anything, what can we discern from it, and how can we share this information without alarming people? And that's one of the other things, is we see a lot of Hollywood movies which portray a very specific picture of something of this nature, and people often just brush it off, and it's not taken seriously, and it can be ridiculed. So there's a lot of factors to this area of ufology, and so of course we have to also use discernment in looking into something like Aurora as well, because there are a lot of factors that we have to take into consideration, as Jen did, who showed me many of these different sites, and I'd be glad to get into the history of all this. And so it's very interesting to see how many different things can change over the years. And even though people see things like UFOs all over the world, even currently, when we look back at historical cases, maybe not just a year ago, 5, 10, 15, but 100 or more, 120 years, it's something that can be very challenging to find some foundational aspects about, but it's not necessarily impossible. I think that, we can get a little bit of information that helps us get a picture of what could have taken place overall. So it's very interesting to be able to go through the entire history of what could have happened with Aurora.
Oh, that is very interesting.
Aurora is, to me, it's one of the only places you can actually go and visit where there's some documentation of something that's actually happened there. Most of the stuff that I know of, it's all speculative that something occurred here or maybe not occurred here. But having been to the Aurora site, you know, it's when you get there, you can feel something that's not quite right. You can tell that something is taking place there that's pretty special, I would say.
I think so. You know, a lot of people seem to feel that in some way or have some curiosity piqued as to what's drawing that there. And there could be many factors. And it's like you said, whenever you are on site, whether it's the crash site or nearby, of course, the direct crash site isn't necessarily accessible to the public,
right.
But you can go to the burial site. And of course, both places have particular feel that people describe. And, you know, you can kind of find some insight in what that could mean. A lot of people, you know, speculate that this could be a potential creature from some other world. And, you know, there are all kinds of ideas about what the alien or creature or entity, whatever it is, could have been, a person. As it says on the plaque, which he describes as Spaceman, it's very interesting that it was erected in 76, I recall. It talks about how the pilot, who the site is also really well known for, basically the legend of a pilot of the spaceship that crashed there in 1897. And so back then, of course, we don't have anything like airplanes, and modern aviation really wasn't even around.
No.
We didn't have the Wright brothers until a little bit later on, 6 years later or so.
Yeah.
So it's really very fascinating where you have different factors that not only match what we have here in Aurora, Texas, but also in several other places around Texas and beyond, all over Northwest, of these sort of airships and sightings, which are taking place during the 1890s and later, where you have what's known as the Great Airship Mystery around the time of 1897. This is when Aurora took place, on April 17th in 1897. And as the story goes, a large metallic cylindrical cigar-shaped object came sputtering down in distress from the south toward a large knoll hill-like area in Aurora, which was towards Judge Proctor's land. And as it came down, it struck his windmill and exploded with metallic debris scattering everywhere, possibly for a mile or more, and was later reported in the Dallas Morning News and a few Fort Worth publications as well that there was a body or the remains of a body that were discovered in the debris. And it was said that it was not an inhabitant of this world, which is very interesting to claim. But of course, we do have to remember that around that time in the 1800s, you could say that not all of the tabloids and the news reports were 100% factual and were, in fact, made up to promote some more sensational stories that people would buy, because newspapers were something that, you know, were much more popular back then, whereas they obviously didn't have internet and fast spiral things that we do now. So selling newspapers was part of the system of business that they operated within. And so to be able to sell fascinating stories, sometimes things were made up. Now, in regard to Aurora, I don't know for certain that this is a completely made up case, but I find that there is a lot of credibility to some of the claims that have been made about the object crashing itself and the possible remains of a body or the navigator of whatever craft or vessel this could have been.
I was just going to mention that one of the things that you brought up that I find to be very interesting is I started taking a look at some of the other dates for newspapers around that time. I very specifically looked at more of the west and southern area of DFW and different sightings that were reported. There were some rather interesting things. For instance, there was a sighting right here by my house. I believe it's fairly close to you, too, in the town of Weatherford. Later on that day, it was seen across the DFW Metroplex. On the date of the crash, what I thought was interesting, at 1 a.m., it was spotted over the town of Loxahatchee. Later on, there was also another report that came out. I believe that one was Stephenville, that there wasn't really so much a time listed on there as it was listed early morning, which is an interesting detail in itself. It was spotted on the ground. The report came back that there were two inhabitants that were seen who were working on it. What I find to be interesting about that is here you have two people who were seen working on it. And then a short time later, you have a follow-up report in the town of Aurora of a crash. Now, of course, there's no way, though, of really that I've seen any way of defining exactly what they consider to be early morning. Only thing I've been able to find is anything from about 2 a.m. until sometime around 5 a.m. back then was when people considered it to be early morning. I'm not sure if you've heard anything about that or have checked into that. I actually got the idea to look into it a little bit further from all of Jim's research, because I know Jim had actually traced it so far. He went all the way back to San Francisco, California, and was able to trace it through different cities from San Francisco.
Well, I think you're making an interesting point that just goes to show that this wasn't an isolated event, and this specific incident here in Aurora could indicate that there may have been a variety of these type of airships, as it were, that were going all throughout the northwest, down through, and into the south. And like you said, many of the reports down here were very active around those dates. And even within the newspaper that the article was printed in, it was only one of several reports of some kind of airship or ominous aerial object that seems to just stick out. And, you know, many of these cases, it could have been made up and hoaxes, and that might be the case. But when you look at the consistency of what was actually being written and then the accounts of people who could have been involved, which corroborate some of these stories and give it a little bit more credibility, perhaps, then you seem to find this correlation between not just what the newspapers are saying, but the local people's accounts that may have been involved directly. And unfortunately now, as we mentioned earlier, the now going to be 122nd year anniversary here soon is just going to be such a historical and a long event to be able to find anyone who could still be alive, which there really isn't. Jim was able to find a few people. Now, if you go to something, you know, within the last 5 or 10 years, maybe you can talk to people who could still be around. But we're talking 120 years ago. And unfortunately, some of the people who Jim talked to were able to give pretty good testimony and account. And we're pretty fortunate to have that he was able to take the time and record the points of view of those who had involvement with this phenomenon and this incident in 1897, whether they were related to or were children at the time of. And he talked to people such as Charlie Stevens and got his account recorded, and we were able to produce a documentary type video, which you can find on our Vortex's YouTube channel, just entitled Aurora, the UFO Crash of 1897. And it's all Jim Mars, and it's a really fascinating, you know, production. It's an honor to have been able to work on that with him. But we updated it with some more pertinent information regarding a lot of the more extensive research that's been, you know, done in this field over the last several years, and we went back and made some edits and reproduced it. So it's a pretty fascinating, you know, just under an hour, it's about 40, 45 minutes. And it's a really cool way to be able to see Jim in action on something he was really passionate about, even all the way back when the stories were republicized in the 70s when he got involved and met aviation writer Bill Cates, the Dallas Morning News. And they went out to the site, and that's when Jim was able to really get involved with what was happening out there and meet quite a few of the people, which, you know, unfortunately turned into a somewhat hazardous situation where this caused the city to close down the cemetery and have a sort of curfew and night watch for a few weeks. And after that happened, the original marker, allegedly, of where the alien was buried, or spaceman, or whatever, could be there, as it says on the plaque. It's interesting to consider that if this is the original headstone, that after this 2 weeks watch in the cemetery, it was stolen. And there have been reports and possible accounts of military or government agents coming out and visiting the town and talking with people as far back as the 50s. And
wow.
While after the initial airship sighting of the of 1897, that didn't seem to really continue consistently for a long period of time. It seemed to only be active during that brief window through 1897 and the surrounding years. But beyond that, you know, of course, people can continue seeing things. But of this magnitude, it's a different type of phenomenon, I think, altogether, when it really brings together many accounts that correlate, and we're dealing with more than just an aerial object, but when you have, like you said, accounts of people communicating with either what seem to be normal people or just other beings from other worlds, if that's how they interpret it or if that's what they are, you know, there are a lot of different perspectives on what we could be dealing with, and so it's not a one-dimensional phenomenon. There are many different parts to this which expand beyond a lot of rational comprehension. And so we're having to expand our mind and be able to be open to the possibility of what we could be dealing with. And when we put glimpse back onto historical events like Aurora, it's fascinating to consider what this could imply for, you know, instances such as if government or military personnel were able to become aware of something such as a crashed object from some extraterrestrial origin. And if this is the narrative that we go with, if it is in fact some kind of alien spaceship, then I'm sure they would like to get their hands on it. Even that far back, that's possible. And if there are any government agents that are, you know, looking at some of these sites in the 50s, they might be wondering about the cemetery. And if they're able to go and take any evidence or anything that indicates that this actually happened, I'd say it would probably be likely that they could do that and, you know, not have to be reprimanded for it, like someone, you know, just in town would. And so, unfortunately, we don't really know where that original stone is, but there is a Dallas lawyer who's looking to offer a reward for the original headstone. I think it's about a $2,000 reward. And if anyone has any information, he's going to be someone who I'll be in contact with. If they'd like to, I'll be glad to get into touch with anyone who has any information on that. But there is a reward for the headstone as well. So something that, you know, could be lost in a river. It could be in a box in someone's basement. It could be in a government facility. We have no idea. And, you know, if it turns up, that would be quite fascinating to find out what's been up to all these years. But it's supposed to indicate that, you know, that there's something there, you know, however far it was buried, which said basically as this object crashed and there was this body that was discovered, the next day they had a funeral. They gave it a formal Christian burial right there in the cemetery. And the remains of this body seemed to infer to the town folk there that it was just not a normal person, or the remains were indiscernible enough so that they weren't sure exactly what it was. But I think that if the story is legitimate and if people really did bury it, I think that they would have to have considered it to be enough of a person to put in a cemetery with other people, if anything. So whether that means it's an alien or some kind of other person from either here or wherever else it could be, I think it's an interesting aspect to this. And as you said, it is part of the historical marker, the official Texas historical marker right there in the cemetery about the legend. And so that's interesting to see that we actually have that. I don't think there are any other historical markers anywhere that talk about something of that nature. And whether it's legitimate or not, I think it's worth considering the possibility. And then, you know, we can see how far we can dig into as far as finding corroborative sources. Again, like Charlie Stevens, who talked about being a boy during the time his father took him out into their pasture. They were farmers, and they had seen the airship sputtering in distress, you know, heading north from the south. And it really seems to be not doing too well and making sounds, and this caught their attention, and little Charlie asked to go and see what it was. And as it continued on and supposedly crashed out in the distance, and of course, really exciting as just into this whole thing, he wanted to go out there and see what it was. But father told him no, that they had to finish the chores. And so the next day, it says all the people came over, and there was just debris everywhere, and they were hauling it off. And of course, they had the funeral. The cemetery in Aurora is just right across the street from the crash site. It's not really too far. What I think is interesting is you mentioned, that you were able to come to the our tour we did, which is just fine because, as you may know, it's a place that is open for people to go at any time, basically, or other than, after hours into the cemetery and things like that. But you can go to Aurora and you'll see the now, I guess, about a year old or so, a city monument that they have, which has a little alien and spaceship and their logo, stylized, spaceship on the logo. So they're really embracing, as you said, Dr. Tony Wheeler. She's really been helping to promote a different theme to a Western style town. And that's really cool because it's something, of course, we talked about earlier about Roswell, places like that. They have a similar connection, and it's something that, while it's on a much smaller scale of, an awareness as far as what people consider to be popular in the field of ufology, Roswell is, like, obviously the number one thing that even people who don't study or know anything about have heard of or kind of have an idea about what it is out there. And so it's great to see that we are able to utilize that city-themed interest in putting together that event back in 2016 to commemorate this incident and to have people come and share about what this could be about, what it could apply, and all the different facets of this phenomenon, I think, in one premier event that we had back in 2016. And we were fortunate enough to have Jim, as you said, and I know you were there as well in attendance. And also we had Chewy Snyder and Nick Redfern and Noe Torres with Stephen Androsko, in addition to Travis Walton. So, it's cool to see that we are able to actually put that together. I don't know if it'll ever be able to happen like that again, but if one day it's possible, we'll see, maybe for the 125th anniversary coming up here in a few years. Something like that I think would be a lot of fun and commemorative as well. It's incredible to think 125 years ago that something like this could have happened, where you have some kind of aerial vessel, it seems, wreck into a windmill, destroying the windmill, which was connected to a well house. And so, fast forwarding a bit, after the burial, they come back and they get to the debris and they start to collect it and have people start hauling it off. And there's, of course, the windmill, like I said, was connected to a well house. And so the water well basically was no longer functional. And so they put a lot of the debris of the metal into the well. And it seems like a lot of that is no longer there now, and the well is also sealed. It's kind of off public limits. We're not able to really see what's in there, but an investigation was opened a few years back by the UFO hunters who sent Pat Uskert, someone who I've worked with, into the well, and he didn't really find anything but a snake, and I thought that was kind of interesting. They let the snake go. I always kind of joked that maybe if they did some examinations on the snake, they might find some of the radiation described from, you know, the exotic metals, but no, they just let it go, and they weren't able to discern or find any, you know, tangible, you know, hard evidence back in the, when they went into the well. But nevertheless, you know, as people have claimed all throughout the years to have found bits and pieces of the metal or had little medallions or things, tokens made from it. They say how it's silvery. It's very light. It's a very dense material, but it's kind of soft and seems to be different than a lot of other metallic alloys, as people describe. And if this is the case, there could be some of that still out there. And that's one of the big things I think should be sought after, is what can we do about finding the metal that could be, you know, the key to what's happened. And I think that from a government standpoint, if this did in fact happen, that again, they would want to be able to get their hands on it. And so if these agents were able to get a hold of any of this mystery metal or exotic, you know, metal or technology that was used to power this vehicle or whatever it was, you know, flying around in, then I think that that would be utilized in some form of back engineering, if at all possible. And of course, you know, this could be the case, and what we're seeing with a lot of these other private, exotic, unconventional technologies. People often consider that UFOs, you know, when you say or hear UFO, you think alien spaceship. Well, I actually think that it's really a limited point of view. And if you can really see how UFO doesn't necessarily mean alien spaceship, but it could be anything that is unidentified that happens to be in the air. And a lot of times people don't know exactly what they're seeing. So it's a very subjective term that everyone could have their own idea on. And if you say UFO and someone thinks alien spaceship, it might not necessarily be that. It could
right.
be a bird, you know, it could be a star or a planet, you know, it could be an airplane, or it could be an alien spaceship. But maybe there's another, you know, explanation for it. We just don't know, or someone might not know, and someone else might. So we just do what we can to just share perspective and see what's actually happening and try to understand the best we can. And when we have something like the idea of an alien spaceship, it can imply a lot of different things. It says a lot about the nature of our reality. And some people would suggest that, you know, to say that we're alone in the universe is almost extremely unlikely and improbable with the models that we're seeing with astrophysics and how many star systems there could potentially be with habitable zones of life. And so it's interesting that we have you know, all of these different things pointing to the possibility that life out in the universe isn't maybe just possible, but it's very probable. And it's only a matter of time before we're really going to see more of what's happening. But one of the strange things that we wonder is, why aren't we really seeing much? If that is the case, shouldn't it be that we're constantly being, you know, invaded and maybe to that extent. But to some degree, you'd think that we have a little bit more activity if there is a really large amount of life, you know, populated throughout the galaxy. But we often wonder, if that is the case, maybe there's a reason there could be a possibility for that. And so, not to speculate too much, but it's fascinating to see all the different formulas that have been pronounced, like Drake's equation, where you can suggest how many planets have habitable, you know, planet zones that have can basically have organic life and things like that, are really, again, a probable cause to show how there's could be a lot of life out there. And we're just now finding out that we may not be alone in the universe. And if these models are correct, then it could be very different than what we just think about, you know, simple ideas of aliens and things like that. But so, you know, when we're dealing with something that people call an airship back then, you know, we don't have the term UFO around. And so we have to just take it as you described earlier, for these different vessels that were going around with crews who would occasionally come out and talk with people. And this could be something that fit in with that time frame, and they would interpret this as such. And maybe now we're seeing things a little bit differently. That's a prevalent theory as well, is that there's a sense of cultural tracking from an advanced group that seems to portray themselves for some kind of emulated incident that shows people or some kind of encounter with technology or things like that just beyond the scope of what the current paradigm is, maybe even for influence or inspiration and things that could allow for people to take those ideas and utilize it in their society. And, you know, this is something inventors might be looked into some degree. And there's a lot of different parts to the aerial phenomenon before modern aviation. And, of course, there are many historical accounts. But when we see something like this right here in Texas, it should be noted that in 1878, I think it is, in Denison, we have a farmer see something up in the sky. And they said that it looked like a flying saucer. And that's actually how, in many ways, we get the term flying saucer. It's saucer. And so it's cool to see here in Texas, that's kind of where that term originates.
Kenneth Arnold, of course, is where everybody assumes it come from, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and of course, there's a description about if the term implies the motion that it makes in the air or if that's the shape of the craft. And so I think we have two different incidents that kind of overlap in some way. And of course, with the Aurora incident, it seems to be a little bit different than the typical airship with a, you know, canvas cabin and different things like that, where it seems more terrestrial, if you will, rather than some kind of exotic metallic hyper advanced technology. You know, airships are a pretty advanced form of technology, but in the scope of what's universally possible, if we're dealing with an off-world civilization, of course, you know, that can be very different. But just a scope of maybe 100 years in advance, with just, you know, different apparatuses that could be invented by people around the world, I think that's that could have been the possible explanation for some of these airship incidents. There are even groups that are talked about, such as NIMSA and the Sonora Aero Club, which were elite scientists that were able to fund these operations of putting together possible schematics and working in airships. And I think that, you know, those could have been out there, but until we can really find some tangible evidence, it's kind of to be determined. But I think Aurora is a little different than some of those. It seems that the metallic aspects indicate that it could have been some kind of other source, whether it's from here or wherever else. I don't know if it was just from ordinary people. So I think that seems to be the general consensus of what people under the impression of when it comes to the Aurora UFO crash. However, I'm not so sure that it's necessarily alien, but it very well could be. And I think that it's something that we'll have a hard time ever really discerning or finding out more about, because in the 70s, after the whole thing was republicized again by aviation writer Bill Case and Jim Martz, who partnered with him, got together out there and they found out some information again that looked like government agents may have been out there as early as the 50s, snooping around, maybe taking samples. As Bill Case said, that there were three drill holes, you know, and Jim would share this often, that there were three holes that looked like they were drilled into the area of the gravesite. And this could indicate that samples were taken and extracted for whatever purposes, if that's something that happened. And of course, then again, with the UFO hunters later on, they did some ground penetrating radar to show that it does seem to be indication of a small child sized grave. And I think that's pretty incredible to consider that there may be something there. But again, to say back in the 70s, when this got into the public, there was a bit of an uproar and there was a notion to exhume the body to really put this to rest. And the Cemetery Association had a fit and basically said, no way. The city threatened to countersue the notion And it was a big deal. And so they decided there's no way they're going to do that. One of the reasons is because they had really bad fever several years before that, which plagued town after the train that the railroad that they had just installed in the area did actually stop in Aurora. It halted a lot of business, people coming through. The town was dying. And this is something that people attribute to why the possibility of this story has been made up to bring in tourism. But I don't think that that's the case, and I don't deny the possibility, but I think that it seems peculiar to suggest in 1897 that instead of saying, you know, come see, we've struck gold, or we've had, you know, we got oil or something, that they say we have an alien spaceman, and I think it's really a bit standing out. So,
now, do you think that the body is still buried there, or do you think maybe the government has somehow or other came and taken that away years ago?
Well, if this is all correct, and we're under the impression that everything that's historically documented, if anything at all, has actually happened, then let's say there is that body in there. It definitely seems like some samples may have been taken, if not at some point, the body having been moved and or just taken altogether. But if there is something still there, I would say that it's hard to tell or to gauge, let's say, something of extraterrestrial origin in the scope of what its kind of biological composition would be like. And let's say, for instance, if it was just a regular old person who crashed and their remains were found, I think that their remains would probably be decomposed to whatever regular degree, you know, anyone else would. But let's say if it is indeed some kind of alien or whatever other hyper-advanced species, well, on that note, then why would it have crashed? But I think if it is buried, you know, then there's got to be some remains or even residual trace. And it's hard to say, you know, if its biological composition would not allow for it to decompose, or if it would decompose much faster. It's hard to say. You have to consider a lot of different factors with that. So I think if we looked more into the field of exobiology, that would be kind of a fascinating study.
Or was it maybe even buried with any of its personal effects that it came here with? That's another question it could be too, which, you know.
That's right. And I think that, you know, some of the lesser known rumors are that there were other bodies or maybe another body that was recovered that the local natives tried to get back to aid, and that kind of trails off. And there's not really much to really substantiate those kind of claims. It's neat to consider, but other than that, it's really just hard to verify something like that. If there are more bodies or if anyone, you know, if any survives. But relating to Roswell, you know, it's also interesting, another UFO connection with Texas is that the Roswell crash debris, supposedly and maybe allegedly, some of the bodies were taken to Fort Worth and to Roswell Air Force Base, and that's maybe where they even remain now. And it's hard to say, you know, where they got the idea to bring it there. And I actually asked the panel at the Roswell Festival UFO panel that they had last year, 70th anniversary, which would have been the 120th Aurora anniversary. I asked if there was any kind of idea as to why perhaps they sent the debris to Roswell, and if it may have been because, and this is what I think is interesting, if they had any similar experience in handling that kind of stuff from some years back as a nod to Aurora. And, you know, it's possible that maybe early on, of course, you know, like we said, this is kind of where modern aviation is really getting a jump start. If there was any interest in this kind of material that possibly could have been recovered by military or authorities, which were have said to have arrived from all over the town and many miles away. So I'm sure that at least some of this material was recovered and, you know, could be stored away somewhere, could be a possible ingredient to what some of these technologies we could be probably using now.
I'm glad to hear that you brought that up, Daniel, that you have the same thoughts about it that I do. Here you have the Roswell Army Air Force right there, who we all know at the time was probably the highest security unit that we had in the entire Army Air Force. The same gentleman that handled the nukes that were eventually dropped on Japan. So very, very secure installation. But yet when they have a report of something like this, who do they call? Carswell. Carswell goes up there. Why call somebody in from Texas for something like that if you already have probably the most qualified people, you would think, right there locally? But yet they decided, hey, let's go ahead and we're going to call Texas.
Yeah, I think so. And that's kind of an interesting outlook, because we do have this incident right here, maybe 20 minutes away from that location. And now, you know, you have an interesting business right there. Of course, Lockheed Martin is a well-known aviation contractor with all kinds of projects that we may still not know about. And I think that it's easy to suggest how these things can, you know, give rise to the idea that maybe they are connected. And I think that they could be. So, you know, with that, it seems like where we have this historical incident, there may not have been modern, you know, jets and planes like that there are now, but back in 47, that was more or less, you know, a different time frame. And so I think, like you said, when you have top guys trying to figure out what to do with it, people like Jesse Marcel, who really gives a powerful account on the event. So the rainy photos, which are the ones in Fort Worth, of him holding what looks like aluminum foil, things like that. And so there's a lot in relation to here in this area regards to this subject of UFOs. And it could have a very powerful, as you said, position. And what Jim said was smoking gun. I think he was onto something. And it's just, it's really incredible to see how after all these years, there's still people who are fascinated by this particular instance. And again, it's really a great opportunity to bring people out and show them the site of what could have been something which in Texas would seem to be unheard of.
Real quick here, Daniel, I've got just one more quick thing for you here. You mentioned earlier the metal that was tossed into the well and, of course, was subsequently removed later on. Do you have any speculation what they may have done with that metal once they took it out of the well?
Well, there are a few accounts of some of the bits of metal and things being taken and put in the shoe boxes in the attics. And some people say have pieces of it and just different things that were made. And one account that I had was not too long ago of someone who got to see it right there in town. And he said that someone invited him to come look at some of the metal, he said, that had hieroglyphic writing on it. And I think that's a pretty fascinating account. If we can get a hold of that, that would be incredible. But, you know, what's interesting is, let's say if there was metal in that well before it got taken out, it could have done a lot of things to contaminate the water if it is indeed some kind of, exotic source. And so what we find happen is in the 40s, you have the Oates family come and move in, and they didn't know anything about it. And a lot of people came throughout the year, and that's how they found out inadvertently that thousands of people came from all over to find out about the spaceman and his ship and, you know, things that happened. So after using the well that they cleaned back out and used for drinking for about 12 years, they ended up getting really terrible illnesses and big, bad goiters and maladies and arthritis that they attributed to that radiated metal that was in the well from that spaceship. And this is something that I think is a common factor in people who have close encounters with the UFO phenomenon.
Some stories where people have come into contact with the ships themselves, they say that it feels like it's biological. It's something that's been grown. Now, if there was material thrown down the well from the ship, do you think it's possible that maybe it could degrade faster than any other earthly material, maybe? Or maybe something along those lines?
Yeah, that's an interesting thought to consider the possibility of that. Let's say, for instance, even if it's not a nuts and bolts vehicle like an airplane, like an advanced airplane, that we are in fact dealing with a wide variety of UFOs in nature, and that there could be biological entities that, you know, might not even just be extraterrestrial, but very well from this world that we just don't really understand. And I think that if there was an intelligent force that was capable of harnessing a body of, let's say, plasmatic metal and some kind of, you know, I would say magnetic state or liquid state, it seems like that would be the ideal form in traveling. And it just is a, you know, one of the things that people consider, that, like you suggested, there's not just an idea that there's a ship, but it itself expresses some kind of and exhibits intelligence, as it is not necessarily moving like with a ballistic motion like jets linearly, but more like sporadic movements, as if maybe a butterfly could easily just move in any direction. So, yeah, I think there's another component to this intelligence that we don't understand fully, and it's not just about making a really powerful airplane, you know, or something like that, but maybe there could be some other paranormal or supernatural component, or just really hyper-advanced scientific technology that we are just beginning to understand. And I think that, of course, it might appear to a more primitive civilization like some kind of magic or godlike power.
Right. Could be.
I've also heard that the local Masonic Lodge also has a journal entry for the day of the crash. And that would be rather interesting, I think, to see whether or not they have that. Of course, that would be interesting if they did have an entry in their journals for that day.
I think so. I'd like to really kind of find more out about the possibility of accessing that. And it would be great to work with you, Matt, on, and Paul, you know, if you're interested, to see what more we can get out of that source, because that is something that has been shared, is that the Masons did record it in their minutes, and it seems like that gives a little bit more credibility to the incident that something happened. Whether it means it's an alien or not, I'm not sure, but at least we can say that maybe something crashed, and, you know, hopefully we can get more information out of that to verify it.
That would be great to be able to sit down and study this some more and work with you, of course, on it, Daniel. I know you have a tremendous amount of knowledge on this subject.
Well, thanks, Matt. I think it's just a fascinating aspect of our reality that we're just beginning to comprehend, and that maybe has been happening for a very long time, maybe since the beginning. But when we're able to look back at these historical cases, it could give us some insight as to what's currently happening and what we could deal with, you know, possible future incidents. And in regard to some of the other incidents that we have here in our Lone Star State, it's really cool because, you know, there's activity all over the place. There are different things happening all over. We have such a vast array of landforms, and there's so much happening. You know, another form of UFO, you could say, is down in closer to the Big Bend in Marfa, Texas. You have these flying lights, and I wouldn't say that they're necessarily metallic, you know, spaceships, but they do seem to have some kind of intelligent movement anyway, and move in synchronicity with each other, which I've seen and recorded. And I don't think that I would say that they are some kind of vehicle that's being piloted, but maybe it itself, as you were suggesting, could be a form of intelligence or entity. And you know, some people get the impression that they could be plasmatic or made of some kind of plasma state of material. And so it's interesting, you know, it makes you wonder if you get too close or you're going to get radiated. A lot of people think that, you know, if for some of the accounts around the area, like in the Cash Landrum case near Houston, you have two people get severely radiated by a diamond, glowing diamond-shaped UFO, and that was in 1980. So there are a lot of different effects that are not very positive about some of these encounters, and we have to be careful to see how this connection can be made with those who have had close proximities with the UFO or UAP phenomenon, which is an unidentified aerial phenomenon.
I think it was rather interesting to hear the way Travis Walton has described his experience, that he feels that now, anyway, he feels that it was a possibility that the ship itself, it was some type of self-defense mechanism that may have been activated on the ship to prevent the ship from being damaged as it was about to lift off. That's a rather interesting point of view, I believe.
Yeah, and he has a very incredible account as well, one where, let's say, for instance, if he accidentally was struck, and it wasn't intentional, and I think maybe even killed, unfortunately.
I think
that
the same
they
thing.
They not only had the power to not only revive him, but to leave him off maybe a little better than he was when they got him. And so I think that's a story of a different kind where, you know, instead of it being like a very traumatic, terrorizing event, which I'm sure in many ways it really was, but not just that that was all, but it may have not been on purpose, and that they actually attempted to reverse the damage caused and leave him a little bit more well off, perhaps, and with a little bit of facial hair that he didn't have before, which, you know, insinuates that he was gone for quite a bit. And 5 days, in fact, that he, you know, was reported missing. And the people he was with, his coworkers, were suspected of having murdered him, which is unfortunate because they have all since have passed lie detector polygraph tests about their accounts. And it's a very strong suggestion to show that all of them are telling the truth about what happened. And whether it was aliens or whatever it was he was dealing with, government, terrestrial entities that we're not very privy of, you know, you can just consider the possibilities. Whatever he experienced, I think they all really agree that he actually did. And I think that goes to show that people that have something of similar nature, which is all over the world, you know, are experiencing some kind of phenomenon that is in relation to several different things. And unfortunately for him, what they encountered was, you know, something that not a lot of people can really walk away from and say that not only were they seen by all these people, but, you know, they got to come back and tell their story.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. I believe that there was a very good possibility that Travis was actually killed during that, that very well could have occurred. And 5 days later, they bring him back, like you said, mended and quite possibly even a little bit better than the way that they found him.
Yeah, the people that he was with, they said when it happened that he looked very much dead. And that's pretty much the reason why they sped off it the way they did. So,
Travis does say that they were very brave to have considered coming back, which they did. They mustered up the courage to figure out what happened, but that's where things got really weird because when they got back, he wasn't there. So, you know, when they decided, well, since he's not here, we can only, what's the next thing to do? Go to the authority and the sheriff. They basically just, you know, you could tell that they were frightened that they had seen something, but he kind of suspected that they killed him.
Or if he had ran off into the woods or whatever, and during the time that they were speeding down the hill, but a lot of that happened pretty quick to where I don't think he would have gotten up and ran much of anywhere in the way that they said he looked when he was laying on the ground. So.
Right. Well, Daniel, do you have any events that are going to be coming up that you're going to be participating in?
Well, there are quite a few things going on around the state that I'm trying to keep up to date with, different things in the local area as well as all around that I try to share about on the Four Texas page. You can check on Facebook. And I upload a lot of the productions from these events onto the YouTube channel, which you can see, you know, anytime. But some of the ones coming up here soon are going to be including the Texas Bigfoot Conference. And that's going to be October 19th, 20th. We're going to have Bob Giblin, who was one of two people who saw and was responsible for the Patterson-Giblin film, which is the famous Bigfoot Sasquatch that's always seen in videos and things, the one that's kind of turning with its hands out. He is actually going to be a guest here at this year's Texas Bigfoot Conference. Very interesting subject and person to be able to have. We're also going to have the Are They Real Cryptozoology Conference out in Crosbyton at the Mount Blanco Fossil Museum with Joe Taylor. That's going to be October 1st and 2nd. And as of, I'd say, this next year, we're probably going to be putting together another tour out to Aurora so people can come and check out, again, the new monument by the crash site and the gravesite at the cemetery as well, kind of a commemorative annual thing. But it's interesting, we just had a UFO closure panel in Dallas at the Dallas Public Library. They invited us out, the local MUFON group and some other speakers in the area to talk about and to share about the government involvement and just about UFOs and alien life in general. So that was an interesting opportunity. And again, a lot of that will be recorded and be able to put onto our YouTube channel for people to see and share with everyone. So there are a few other events happening around the Fort Worth area. We have Satori, which is a monthly meeting with different speakers on various topics. And we try to share about other programs happening within the area. And if people have different things that they're putting together or hosting, we try to let people know about that. So if anyone wants to share that information with me, I'd be glad to get with them about that. And of course, what you guys are doing here with the Alien Podcast is really awesome.
Well, thank you.
Where is that Bigfoot conference going to be located at?
Yeah, the Bigfoot conference is going to be located in Jefferson, Texas, which has now been declared the Bigfoot capital of Texas, which is because a lot of people may not know, and it may sound strange, but Texas actually is a hotbed of activity for Bigfoot and cryptids, which is basically creatures of the study of cryptozoology, which is about unknown and hidden animals and strange creatures. So the Bigfoot conference here in Texas has been going on for several years, and we're honored to be able to have really prestigious guests like Bob Gitlin being able to come out, and Nick Redfern, Wild Blackburn, Ken Gerhardt, and others for this year's event in Jefferson, Texas.
I know I'm really looking forward to that one.
Yeah, I want to try to make it down there for that.
Yeah, you really need to.
And, yeah, and on the note of cryptozoology, just a few weeks back was the 49th anniversary of what is also known as the Lake Worth Monster, another local legend right here in the Fort Worth area, where you have this, what was called Goatman, going around in around 69 and the Lake Worth area and kind of terrorizing some of the local people coming out into the park area throughout the years, and even supposedly threw a tire at several partygoers from a bluff. And anyway, on the close to the anniversary a few weeks back, got a little meetup together out there and did a tour of all the sites. And that was a lot of fun. We're planning on getting ready for next year's 50th anniversary of the Lake Worth Monster Bash, and they're going to put together a big event with speakers and talking about the Lake Worth Monster, and that'll be a fun one as well. So that's going to be October of 2019.
I know you've got the videos of those posted as well. I've already been watching some of those. I've, of course, watched the Lyle Blackburn as he was speaking about it, and just a really fascinating subject there. And of course, whenever you had the Lake Worth Monster actually coming out there to throw a tire down, that was pretty neat, Daniel.
Oh, yeah. Pretty scary. But, you know, we had a great time, and it was great to be able to have everyone be able to go out there and see some of the places that could have had some phenomenon. And, you know, it's a fun instance as well, whether it happened or not. You know, it's one of those things like Aurora. It's who you talk to. Everyone will have their own opinion. But throughout their years, again, you do find people who may have a legitimate account of, oh, yeah, I saw this, or this is what happened. Just like Aurora, you have people that definitively say that they were there and they saw something. And unfortunately, none of those people are alive. But maybe for, let's say, things like the Lake Worth Monster, there are people who are willing to share. And we are fortunate enough to have people like Gino, who was sharing his account of seeing the Lake Worth Monster's red eyes. And that's kind of a spooky thought to have encountered something like that. But it's all in good fun as well, because it's something to promote, you know, the awareness of this. And so, yeah, we have a good time bringing people out and looking at props, and we'll have more information on that. And of course, the idea that this could have been thrown in a costume in the city there, and the Fort Worth Nature Center has been doing it for a few years and hosting an event called the Monster Bash, Lake Worth Monster Bash. So they're going to have the 50th one next year. And with some of the groups that I manage, like Texas Cryptozoology Network, we'll be helping to share more about those types of events. But for those interested in Aurora and other UFO cases and alien studies and just astronomy and things like that in general, we have the Texas UFO Network and a plethora of UFO-related and space-related videos on YouTube as well. We try to share for people that may not be able to attend the meetings in person. So sometimes we do a live stream, and that's something you can see on our Facebook.
Now, is that the easiest way for people to check out everything that you have going on is by seeing what you have on Facebook, or is there some other way that they can also reach out to you?
For YouTube, if they're interested in the videos, that's going to be youtube.com/WarTexasNetwork, and you can see the whole archive of all the material that's up there, and there's still a lot being put on there. For anyone that's interested in seeing, just news, updates, information, events, you can go to the Facebook page of War Texas, kind of the central hub for a lot of the different groups like the Texas UFO Network and Texas Cryptozoology Network. And for anyone interested in those kinds of subjects, we try to share, a decent amount of material that people can check out at any time. And so if anyone's interested in my personal page, I've got one on Facebook as well. That's just Daniel Allen Jones, and I share about all kinds of things that I'm involved with, whether it's the local group meetings like Satori or MUFON, which is a local MUFON group in Dallas, Fort Worth area, gets together at Grapevine, and I do the program directing for that. But we also have a lot of other things happening around the area, other events, and I'm also a musician and music instructor, and so I do a lot of music and drumming videos and things like that, but also all kinds of fun stuff when I'm on my adventures and with my brother Matthew. So we have a good time.
Seem to be one busy man, that is for sure.
Yeah, it's just a lot to keep up with, but I'm glad to be able to connect and, with everyone in the community and help to, promote awareness of some of these subjects, and hopefully here soon be able to produce some of the material I've been working on to publish for some time, and have a book, for instance, that I'm putting together on Aurora specifically. And on that note, our buddy Noe Torres, he actually did publish a book on Aurora as a play, and it's a very interesting piece. You can go onto Amazon and go to his page and find that, Aurora. It's a theatrical version, a reenacting. So it's pretty interesting to see, and I'm glad that there's more material and he put that together. I'm planning on putting together something that sort of documents just the incident itself, and have many other things kind of coming through the pipeline in regard to some publishing.
That is rather interesting. I know you've certainly provided us with a whole lot of information about the subject tonight, and we greatly appreciate it.
Yes, we do.
Well, Paul, and I'm glad to have taken this time with you guys, and of course, I'd be glad to come back on to share with you any other time.
That's a definite. We're definitely going to have you back on there. I think we could probably talk to you for hours and possibly days at a time.
Yeah, I think we'll have you on in the future. And I think next time we'll talk more about cryptids. I think we've yet to get into that on this podcast yet, but we're going to. And you'd be somebody that would certainly be a person to talk to about a lot of that, especially in Texas, where there's so much of that stuff that goes on that a lot of the outside world doesn't know about. So, yeah, in the future, I think we're going to do that.
Well, that would be great. And it's really, I think, a powerful notion to bring these subjects into the public's awareness and allow for a platform like you guys are doing for these topics to be expressed and to be talked about and without ridicule or just being completely dismissed. But, allow for people to see maybe there's more to this and we can take it into consideration. So you guys are doing a great job. It's important to have this network like this and to be able to share this kind of material and get content out there to the public. So let's do what we can to work together. And as Jim Mars would always say, none of us are as smart as all of us. And so if we can just combine our powers together, we're going to be able to do some great work in this subject of UFOs or cryptozoology and just all of these different mysterious parts of our reality. I think that, we can continue uncovering and do a great job together.
Very, very true words there.
And we're just getting started, so.
Yes. All right, Daniel, my friend, I want to thank you for coming on here tonight and sharing just a wealth of information with all of us.
My pleasure, Matt. Glad to have been with you guys. Thanks, Paul, and we hope to be back soon.
And you tell everybody in your camp that all of us say hi over here and keep up the good work.
Appreciate it, guys. Take care.
Thank you.
Until next time.
Thank you, sir.
And there you have it.
To find out more about the show, or promptly send your death threats, or for your free, no obligation anal probe, please visit alienpodcast.net.